What does it mean to be a Christian woman in our feminized secular society? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May is Ladylike, Living Biblically. Browse before you buy at issuesetc.org, or you can purchase Ladylike by calling Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. A great Mother's Day gift, Ladylike, Living Biblically, the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. They're always digging up fossils of all kinds, dinosaurs and other creatures that evolution says lived and then went extinct hundreds of millions of years ago. There's an interesting connection that became popular probably about 30 years ago, a theory about the connection between modern-day birds, you know, the things with feathers and beaks that run around your front yard, and ancient dinosaurs. What is that connection, and why does a recent fossil discovery of a bat-winged dinosaur pose a problem for that model? Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Joining us to discuss this question and this alleged discovery of a bat-winged dinosaur, Dr. Joel Heck. He's professor of theology at Concordia University, Texas, author of the booklet In the Beginning, God, Creation from God's Perspective. He's going to be one of the speakers at a conference titled The Origin of Diverse Kinds of Life, Dinosaurs, July 6th through 8th at Concordia University, Ann Arbor, Michigan. Dr. Heck, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd. It's a pleasure to be back.
What's the prevailing theory or idea about the connection between modern-day birds and extinct dinosaurs, and why does this discovery of a bat-winged dinosaur not fit that theory?
Well, the prevailing theory is that our modern birds evolved from dinosaurs, although I wouldn't want our listeners to try to imagine a T-Rex all of a sudden sprouting wings and feathers and beginning to fly. I mean, that's sort of a ludicrous picture if one brings that into one's mind's eye. But they think that modern birds evolved from ancient dinosaurs, very small dinosaurs, that eventually, as the arms grew, they developed into wings, some feathered and some not feathered. Probably the biggest problem isn't so much specific to this discovery as it is specific to fossils in general, because fossils aren't automatically formed. Most creatures, when they die, die on the surface of the land or float up to the top of the water and are scavenged by various other kinds of predators that eat not only animals but also insects. So unless a creature dies quickly, suddenly, and is completely buried, it's not going to be preserved for later generations. And so anytime you find a fossil, you have to ask, how did that fossil get there in the first place? And the best answer to that question is Noah's flood, where you have a rapidly rising water, you have massive amounts of topsoil being scoured off by waves, and part of it coming as a result of earthquakes and lots of other catastrophic events, and then animals fleeing for their lives, many of them getting trapped in certain corners of the earth that end up being fossil graveyards and then completely buried, very suddenly and very completely buried, so that there's not only no scavenging going on, but there's no oxygen that could oxidize the creature, and you end up with the entire creature being completely covered, no oxygen able to get in, and then they're preserved over the many hundreds or thousands of years. So I'd say the biggest problem is anytime there is a fossil, you ask how it is that the fossil got there in the first place.
So this discovery is, at least what they think they found, is a small dinosaur with extended finger bones that appear to be wing-like, but yes. There's no feathers associated with this, as there have been, or at least they're believed to have been, with other dinosaur or transitional forms between dinosaurs and birds.
Yeah, no feathers discovered there. And I'm assuming that they're thinking that, well, this is a gliding creature. They say in the article that they don't know whether it was flying or gliding. But if you read the article carefully, it appears to me that they're leaning towards the gliding because they found this appendage on the end of the wing, either at the wrist or the elbow, that suggests that's something that a flying squirrel has had. And, of course, flying squirrels glide rather than fly. So they're probably suggesting that. And then they're trying to create in the mind of the reader, as well as the person who sees the artist's impression of this dinosaur, that the next stage would have been the developing of feathers. And, in fact, I think it's almost funny that the image that they put at the introduction to the article is a creature that is gliding, but it's got feather-like features to it. So they're trying to suggest this is an early glider who is in the process of evolving or developing feathers, and probably not the case.
Now, so the problem here really is that they're trying to explain why a creature would have this structure of its arms if it weren't a creature kind of taking to the air in some sense. Is that the problem?
I guess that's the problem. In a sense, creationists don't really have any problem with there being winged creatures, reptilian creatures like the Archaeopteryx. I mean, nobody suggests that the Archaeopteryx didn't actually exist, but it was totally and completely a bird. What evolutionists are running into is the problem with coming up with the transitional links or forms in between certain kinds of species and kinds that we know have existed. And so they're trying to develop this narrative to explain how you get from A to B when A is, say, a non-flying dinosaur and B is the modern bird. And so they say in places in the article, such as this comment from Zeng, it reminds us that the early history of flight was full of innovations, not all of which survived. So that's a partial solution to the problem of a lack of transitional forms. Well, there would have been lots of forms, but not all of them survived, so we can't expect there to be any evidence for that, which is a nice sort of verbal jujitsu that allows people to look at the lack of evidence and take the lack of evidence as evidence for things that probably happened in their opinion, but haven't been preserved in the fossil record.
So the bird-like dinosaurs, and everyone's familiar with the picture of this flattened image there in the fossil record of an almost completely intact creature that obviously has feathers. They're imprints of feathers. It's rather amazing. And looks a lot like, in its general outline, a bird. The evolutionists look at that and say, that's a bird-like dinosaur. And you look at it and say, that's a bird-like bird.
Yes, it's totally a bird, it seems to me. The problem for evolutionists is that these fossils don't come with dates and they don't come with labels that say who their ancestors were, who their descendants were, when they lived. This is entirely interpretive, and that leaves the field wide open for them. They can put whatever labels on them that they want to and say, you know, I'm a scientist, and of course science rules the world. And we are objective, totally objective. We just look at the evidence. But I do believe that science is objective. The problem is that scientists are not.
When they try and kind of explain away the evidence that they have, it's hard to explain away a creature that's got bat-like wings. What do you think they're looking at there, a small dinosaur with bat-like wings?
Yeah, they're probably looking at this may well be a species that existed that has not previously been discovered, and that's sort of what the article is suggesting, and I wouldn't have a problem with that automatically, but this is an early article, and other scholars haven't had a chance to look at it, especially Christian scholars who are involved in the scientific and paleontological fields. So a lot of times some of these finds that have a certain kind of description to the find follow a relatively common cycle of things. A scientist or a group of scientists discover something, come up with an idea, and make some strong claims, and those claims then get spread worldwide. And then after a few days or weeks or even months, then other scientists get to see the data and look a little bit more closely at it. Like these fossils of whales that are supposed to have appendages that may be rudimentary legs so that the whales came ashore and evolved into land animals. But then when people look at them more closely, they're not rudimentary legs at all, probably weren't used for any kind of transportation. So the secular scientists themselves, including evolutionists, say that the original claims overreached a bit. And then finally, scientists who are Christians actually get to take a look at the data and analyze the situation and publish their findings. And it turns out not to be originally what they thought that they were. But I really don't have a problem with this being a dinosaur fossil having bat wings capable of flying or more likely gliding, nor do creationists really have a problem with the idea of feathered dinosaurs. They're certainly not ruled out by the Genesis record of creation, but it's still a huge leap to go from a dinosaur that could fly to the modern-day bird and to say that the one evolved into the other, particularly if you have a non-flying dinosaur that didn't fly at all, and then it's supposed to evolve into the birds that we have today. From what I've read, there is a huge difference in the kind of lung that an avian creature uses, a bird-like creature uses, versus the kind of lung that a land-living creature that doesn't have any ability to fly, the kind of lung that it has. And it's extremely different and very difficult to explain how the land-type creature could have evolved into a bird given those kinds of lung structures.
Dr. Joel Heck is our guest. He'll be with us for a few minutes on the other side of the break on this Friday afternoon, May the 1st. We're talking about the discovery of a bat-winged dinosaur, its implications for the theory and the model of evolution. After our conversation with Dr. Heck concludes, we're going to take up two issues with Chris Rosebro of Fighting for the Faith. One, a Hebrew Roots movement leader here in the St. Louis area is pleading guilty to wire fraud to the tune of $3.3 million cheated out of investors. We'll find out what Chris thinks about that. Then we'll get his thoughts on labyrinths, the kind of walkways. They're not mazes because you couldn't get lost in one, but they are walkways, usually in some kind of a circular spiral pattern that some Christians walk and do their contemplative prayer. Chris has his concerns, as do I. We'll see what they are in hour two of Issues, Etc.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Repentance and forgiveness, sin and grace, law and gospel, more than cliches, real preaching for real people in need of hearing the real Christ. Christ for you and the divine service at St. Paul Lutheran Church of Hamel, Illinois, where we gather every Saturday night at 6 and on the Lord's Day, Sunday mornings at 7:45 and 10. Look for the Church of the Neon Cross on I-55 between exits 30 and 33. Find us on the web, stpaullutheranchurchhamel.org. St. Paul Lutheran Church of Hamel, where there is the forgiveness of sins, life and salvation for the people of God.
Did you know that Luther Academy has been providing continuing education for confessional Lutheran pastors and lay people worldwide for more than 20 years? Luther Academy promotes confessional Lutheran theology through conferences, scholarly exchanges, and publications like Logia, the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatic Series, and Luther Digest. Find out more about Luther Academy and sign up for their free email newsletter at lutheracademy.com. lutheracademy.com. Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the alleged discovery of a bat-winged dinosaur. Dr. Joel Heck is our guest. He's professor of theology at Concordia University, Texas, author of the booklet, In the Beginning, God, Creation from God's Perspective. And he's going to be one of the speakers at a conference titled The Origin of Diverse Kinds of Life Dinosaurs, July 6th through the 8th at Concordia University in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Dr. Heck, tell us a little bit about this summer's Creation Conference.
Yes, it'll be our third annual conference. The first two were held at Concordia University, Wisconsin, and this conference will be held in Ann Arbor, Michigan, Concordia University Ann Arbor, which is really part of the Concordia University, Wisconsin University now. We have one university and two sites, but Ann Arbor is the location, and it's going to focus on dinosaurs in particular. This current school year, this semester, spring semester, I had a guest speaker come from ICR, the Institute for Creation Research in Dallas, and talk about dinosaurs, Mr. Brian Thomas. And he's not going to be at the Ann Arbor conference, but we are going to have two other individuals, Tim Clary from ICR, who will take Brian Thomas's place and talk about the role of dinosaurs, the place of dinosaurs in the created order, and how that relates to the Genesis flood. And then Kevin Anderson, who was one of our speakers last year, is coming back this year and going to talk about dinosaur fossils, and in particular talk about the soft tissue finds that have surfaced in a number of dinosaur digs, most eminently at Hell Creek, Montana, where evolutionist Mary Schweitzer discovered T-Rex remains that were not only apparently remains of dinosaurs that died recently, but actually when they dug these dinosaur remains up, there was a cadaverous odor. In other words, the remains smelled bad, which would not be the case if, in fact, dinosaurs became extinct 65 million years ago, which is the standard evolutionary perspective. So Kevin Anderson and Tim Clary will be dealing with dinosaurs in four major addresses, four plenary addresses. Dr. Gary Locklear and I will also talk about creation and evolution and its impact in our world today. Dr. Locklear teaches computer science at Concordia University, Wisconsin, especially interested in the educational side of it. And I'll be talking about the how it is that you teach creation and respond to evolutionary claims. And I'll be looking in particular at the impact of evolutionary thinking on our world today. So there will also be workshop sessions. And for the first time ever, we're going to broadcast the conference back to the Mequon campus. So we're holding it in Ann Arbor. We're going to broadcast the main sessions back to the Mequon campus so people would be able to attend either in Ann Arbor or in Mequon, and perhaps this will be the first step in even wider distribution of this conference in subsequent years, particularly within the Concordia University system, but not exclusively there, of course. So we're looking forward to our third annual conference and hope that many of your listeners, especially those living in the southeastern Michigan area or within a couple hundred miles of that, will come on up and visit us.
You can find out more about this conference, The Origin of Diverse Kinds of Life, Dinosaurs, July the 6th through the 8th at Concordia University in Ann Arbor, Michigan, at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. One of the things that often strikes me, Dr. Heck, about kind of the way that the theory is popularly promulgated about dinosaurs and birds is the artwork. If you just Google bird dinosaur or something like that, you will get not only pictures of the fossil that is so famous now that looks strikingly like a bird, not exactly like a modern bird, but it certainly looks like something of a variation on a kind of a bird. But you'll also get a lot of paintings, pictures, renderings of this thing as a dinosaur running along the ground, fighting, pursuing prey, all of these kinds of things. How does kind of the popularizing of evolution in a lot of ways depend on the way that these things are depicted artistically?
Well, yes, the artists are very clever and are reflecting the ideology of the person that is the scientist that's behind the particular fossil that's being depicted. So they have to be in agreement with the science person, and they understand that a picture is worth a thousand words. So the way that you depict something artistically has a powerful impact upon people's minds, and they think that if you can see it, if you can reconstruct it, it must have been that way, and they don't realize that there are frequently, in fact, most of the case, there are huge leaps between what we actually know about this particular fossil find and the way that this creature actually looked way back then.
And the leaps are as evident here with the bird dinosaur connection as with anything else. I was just looking a few moments ago at a kind of the alleged tree from dinosaur to bird, and it's amazing to look at wherever you draw the line between dinosaur and bird on this evolution. The transition between dinosaur and bird is striking. They don't look like the same creature.
They don't, and that really reflects Darwin's own tree of life in the Origin of Species. If you look at how he imagined and how he drew out these line drawings from a handful of initial forms of life to the forms that we have today, the reality is that all the fossil evidence that we have is at the very tail end of this tree of life. We don't have any of those original forms or early forms or ancestors of the current creatures that are known to be alive today. And that really reflects a perspective that says all of this life appeared suddenly in a short span of time, and that coincides nicely with the opening chapters of Genesis. And it even coincides nicely with what's known as the Cambrian explosion, where some 600 million years ago, if you buy into the evolutionary timescale, the claim is that at the Cambrian explosion, there were all kinds of forms of life that appeared suddenly, and that creates a huge problem for an evolutionary, or one might say a gradualistic theory about the origin of life and the origin of species. It should be slow and gradual and take place over millions of years, and yet below the Cambrian rock layer, you have next to nothing, and then all of a sudden you've got a wide variety of life forms and some really quite complex forms of life as well. Hard to explain from an evolutionary perspective.
Now, the age of this, and I wanted you to speak briefly about that as we wrap up our conversation, the age of this particular bat-winged dinosaur is alleged to be 160 million years ago. How do they arrive at numbers like this, and how accurate is their clock, so to speak, when they do this?
Yes, that would be from the Jurassic period, at least according to the geological periods that they assigned to that. And as a relative dating mechanism, we don't really have any problem with the names of those various layers, rock layers, but we would have a problem with the ages assigned to them and the amount of time that are supposed to have elapsed for each of those eras. But typically, you can read this in the World Book Encyclopedia. I've looked at our own World Book Encyclopedia in our library at Concordia, Texas, and found two conflicting statements in two different volumes by two different authors. One article, and I could get the exact reference if I had a couple of minutes, but one article talks about the age of the fossils is determined by the age of the rocks in which the fossil is found. And then you turn to another volume and another article, and how is it that we determine the age of the rocks? Well, that very next article says, well, you determine the age of the rock layers by the age of the fossils that are found in them. So this would be an example of a classic example of circular reasoning. You date the fossils by the age of the rocks, and you date the rocks by the age of the fossils, and you don't ever let anybody know that we're really using circular reasoning here.
And if it goes on long enough, I suppose, no one's questioning the original premise here. And they're just saying, well, we know that this layer is this old. Why? Because we found fossils of that age in it. But if that's not clearly stated, then pretty soon that circular reasoning is lost, but way back in the background someplace.
Yes, and it's even true that there is a little bit of deception that's going on when the various methods for determining the date, the radiometric dating methods, are used. Typically, when a fossil remains or some fossil remains are submitted for testing, whether it's by uranium lead or potassium argon or carbon 14, the people doing the test will ask the person that submits them, how old do you expect it to be? And so they'll tell them how old they expect it to be, and voila, it usually ends up being about what the paleontologist originally thought it would be. And they almost always use only one method rather than multiple methods. Almost inevitably, if a particular fossil remain, whether it's a plant or an animal, is tested by multiple methods, you get widely varying dates from, say, potassium argon versus uranium lead. And they really only do one of the testing mechanisms, and they don't even try to cross-check their results by testing it through another method.
Finally, with a few minutes left to us here, how should Christian parents explain news stories like we found here of a fossil allegedly 160 million years old of a bat-winged dinosaur? How should they explain that simply to their kids, just in terms of the age, these hundreds of millions of years?
Well, all of these creatures, we don't want to say, like some have said, that the devil created these fossils and put them in the rocks in order to deceive people. That's really not an acceptable position among any of the creationists that I know, anybody that takes that message seriously. But to recognize that these would be remnants of creatures that God created during the first week of creation, and that creation happened thousands of years ago rather than millions or billions of years ago, and that there is a huge battle that's going on for the minds and souls of men and women all over the world, a good portion of which is based upon the assumption of the truth of Darwinism. And so they end up with argumentation, and they have the majority on their side, because the majority of the world is not Christian, but the documentation is coming from a very skewed perspective that is a biased perspective, has already concluded the age that they have to find in order to make evolution seem plausible to someone who reads the story or sees the picture or attends the museum. And so we just understand the perspective where they're coming from, and have to do our own reinterpreting, knowing that these fossils are really only thousands of years old rather than millions of years old.
What should we say simply to our children about dinosaurs and their extinction?
The dinosaurs probably were on the ark. I mean, two of every creature were on the ark. They would have been small dinosaurs. They would have been juveniles so that they could reproduce after the flood. The average size of a dinosaur, from what I've read, is about the size of a full-grown sheep. And especially if they're young, they would be relatively small. Going on the ark would have easily fit on the ark, and after they come off the ark, would be able to reproduce because they'd be young enough for that. But that the dinosaurs typically became extinct during the major climatic changes that took place in the first hundreds of years after the flood. In fact, some of the work that's been done, particularly by a scientist named Michael Ord, has suggested that there was an ice age, but only one, and that it lasted, if my memory serves me correctly, 600 to 700 years, and that those major changes that took place during those few centuries would be what caused so many of the dinosaurs to become extinct. They had previously lived in fairly warm and lush climates, and then when these changes following the flood took place on our surface of the Earth and brought a lot of snow and ice to certain parts of our planet, that's when the dinosaurs died.
Dr. Joel Heck is professor of theology at Concordia University, Texas, author of the booklet, In the Beginning, God, Creation from God's Perspective. He will be one of the speakers at a conference titled The Origin of Diverse Kinds of Life, Dinosaurs, July 6th through the 8th at Concordia University in Ann Arbor, Michigan. You'll find a link to this creation conference under the Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org. Dr. Heck, thanks for being our guest.
It's been my pleasure.
When we come back, Chris Roseboro of Fighting for the Faith is going to join us. We're going to talk about two issues. One, labyrinths. You see sometimes them in churchyards or in neighborhoods, these maze-like structures that people walk and pray and think and meditate. We'll also talk about a leader of the Hebrew Roots movement recently found guilty of wire fraud. Chris Roseboro of Fighting for the Faith is next on Issues Etc.
T-shirts, shorts, sun. Get in shape this spring at Arch Fitness of Cottage Hills, Illinois. Arch Fitness offers adult boot camps on weekday evenings and on weekday and Saturday mornings. For more information, check out the Facebook fan page for Arch Fitness or call Kevin Reisick at 618-670-6952. Arch Fitness is located at 127 West MacArthur Drive in Cottage Hills, Illinois. Get AFIT this spring at Arch Fitness of Cottage Hills, Illinois.
Bethany Lutheran College is pleased to sponsor Issues Etc. and Lutheran Public Radio. Bethany Lutheran College is located in the picturesque river town of Mankato, Minnesota, and is committed to making Christian higher education affordable for all with generous financial aid packages available. At Bethany, you'll find stimulating academic programs, a friendly atmosphere, and opportunities to grow both in intellect and in your faith, all within the framework of a supportive Christian environment. For more information, visit us on the web at blc.edu.
Essential exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Zion Lutheran, Muscoota, Illinois. Redeemer Lutheran, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Grace Lutheran, Auburn, Michigan. Zion Lutheran, Pleasant Plains, Illinois. The Lutheran Church of the Incarnate Word, Rochester Hills, Michigan. Zion Lutheran, Laramie, Wyoming. Redeemer Lutheran, Seymour, Indiana. Zion Lutheran, East Moline, Illinois. And Peace Lutheran, South St. Louis County. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, and click support. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll advertise your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. issuesetc.org, click support. The Issues Etc. 300.